you go up the ranks and you see more and more, like you're flying closer and closer to the sun, so to some degree. The sausage factory is a big factory, right? There are many clean rooms until you reach the core of it, where the actual sausage is made. But the closer you get, the more you're also like, okay, if I'm not doing this, then who is?
You have the senior engineer who is laying out this viable plan of a project which seems very ambitious and challenging. I think having an engineer kind of describe that puts the team at a little bit of an ease, knowing that they'll have some guidance and direction on an ongoing basis from an engineer, not just management is telling them to go from, let's say, go to Rust or whichever language to this other language or whatever migration they have to.
There's a significant and material difference between a senior software engineer saying something and a senior VP saying something. If you read it up from a script, the same words coming out of two different mouths, that will, to me, make a difference. And it might just be me protecting myself, but I know if I'm in front of a senior engineer who I trust and look up to some degree, and there's a VP who, the unfortunate thing is you don't quite trust because they don't have this building thing going on. Like, if they say the same, there's a difference.
So now you're a founding engineer at a new startup called BeyondWork. But before that, you were a distinguished engineer at Uber, super impressive since that's, you know, pretty much the highest one can go on the IC ladder. So we were messaging some of the engineers that you worked with before. Shout out to Jasper, if he's listening. He mentioned that we should ask you about what you call the reverse sausage architecture that y'all use to build a lot of the systems at Uber. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think, first of all, let me just say, there's probably a lot of terms you come up with as you go along, just to like, because you don't necessarily have a language for it. So I reverse sausage, I don't think that's like an official term anywhere. It's just really clear. And I wonder what he meant. I'm sure it's related to the fact that there's a lot of like dirtiness involved in building stuff. If you don't like accept that as a fact, you're going to have a hard time. So, like accepting the fact that the world is like messy, and it's unclean, and it's unperfect, and I think that underlies almost everything we built as like a foundational principle. Not because, of course, we don't like say, it does, nothing matters. We can just like do whatever. Quality doesn't matter, but just because if you build something for perfection, there's some people find it nice to like build something that's like awesome and completely correct. But also, in my experience, turns out that you spend a lot of time doing that. And all that time, you're not getting any kind of real value while doing it. You're building for something and you might never be able to actually attain it. So it's much better to like get it out there and running, to like experience, does it work? Does the thing you thought would work, is that actually how it is going to be in real life? Because even though you built this perfect thing in isolation, put it out there, it doesn't work. So I think there's a lot of that, and I think that both underpins like all the technical stuff we built, but also how we built it, like the culture we build around it, like how we think about building. So yeah,
interesting. Makes sense. Was there a specific project that you can talk about that sort of either was the epiphany of that, or maybe first it got you to start thinking about, okay, this sort of reverse sausage process?
So most of my time at Uber was spent building deployment platforms, right? And so we built a fairly large-scale deployment system for stateful workloads.
We should talk more about this.
Yeah. And we started doing this back when like Docker was very new, like Kubernetes was like an alpha or whatever. The first alpha version was just out, and we were like, we should put databases in containers. And everybody's like, you're like, are you insane or what's going on here? Because it doesn't make any sense. But we did that. And it turned out to be like a huge success. And when I left, we had basically converted all of Uber's non-stateless, which is called stateful, but like there's so much stuff that goes into stateful, that's like semi-stateful, whatever. It was all running on one platform that we built. And that platform was kind of based on the fact that nothing is perfect. Which is a bit scary. You have databases, you have data, you don't want to lose it. So what do you do about that? But there's also so much when you run a large-scale infrastructure that also involves like real hardware that can fail at any point in time. Like, how do you model that into a perfect system? Like, you can't. You kind of have to build it in a way that basically anything can happen at any point in time. So having like a state machine or a complete, like, in this state, and we can do this. Well, one day somebody's going to just rip the power off, and then there was no state for that, or whatever. So building that system in a way that is like, it can basically handle anything without you having to like deal with it. I think that's one example of this, where like, once you accept that, okay, we're not going to like know every single change that happened, like this, the exact chain of events that led to something, like they say server goes down, a rack is offline suddenly, like the chain of events leading up to that, you're never going to be able to fully track that. So if you build a system that is based on event sourcing to kind of determine the state of the system, it's not going to work. So that's just my opinion, of course, but that's how I see it. And that's kind of the realization that if you build a system that tries to be perfect and like knows every single change in the system, it's not going to work. So that and I think that kind of led us to build this deployment system that in many ways is like Kubernetes, but also quite different.
So that's interesting, because I think there are two aspects of what you're mentioning. At least what I'm reading is there are two different parts to this. One is, when you're designing a system, you can't expect everything that you rely on to be perfect, because like you said, someone would pull out the power cable and you have no idea what the series of events that happen. So that goes back to like assuming failure is a regular mode of operation. It's not an anomaly. It's something that's pretty normal. There is another aspect to this, which is, as you're trying to build something, which is putting stateful systems on containers, I mean, even right now, when you talk to a lot of people about that, they're like, are you sure you want to do that? Do you know what you're doing? And when you talk to stateful application owners, like people who are running databases, and you're like, hey, we're going to roll this thing out, and you're approaching it with pragmatism, you know the system that you've built is not going to be perfect until you actually put it out there, until it runs in production, until you see some failures. I'm curious, in your case, when you were talking to these stateful application owners saying, hey, we are going to run your apps on this new system, we have designed it with failures in mind, but obviously we can't think of everything, and there are some things we'll only see. How do you go about bringing them on board to say, let's put it here, let's go, let's take this forward? Because I think it's about like very similar to the advice you see startup founders getting. It's like, hey, put a product out there. If it's perfect, it's probably too late already. I think same is to be said about engineering systems too, although engineers don't tend to think like that. It's like, let's put it out there, let's see how it works, and then iterate. But not everyone is super comfortable with that. And I'm curious how you got people on board there.
Yeah, and to be honest, we did have a lot of resistance from different parts, sometimes surprising resistance, sometimes also just completely expected. And so like, we came with a set of different like value propositions around like, why would this be a good idea? One thing about like optimizing like fleet optimization, you can kind of get rid of a lot of like duplicate tooling that you have. Like if you're managing Cassandra in one way, you're managing MySQL in another way, two different teams. Like there's a lot of waste involved in that. Of course, there's also like people who are doing this probably have built their own tools and they're kind of heavily invested in those. Like they think they're pretty good, but then so I think a large part of it. So we bootstrapped out of the project called Schemaless, something we also Uber built, like a key value store, distributed key value store that we built ourselves based on MySQL. And that was basically something we built on part of our team. So we could basically take that and like, okay, so we had a lot of trust there, so we could get started there. But as we kind of branched out to all the other different teams, that's where tension appeared. So it wasn't like we didn't just like show up and say, oh, we're just going to do this, and everybody said, yay! which was like quite the opposite. But it was a really long, like we started this back in like 15, and it was a long stretch up until 24, I think, to kind of get everybody on board. And I don't think there's any better way of doing it. Like, I don't think there's another way, because as you say, you basically have to win the trust of both the people who are currently operating, but also the people who are using the systems, and they have to see the value. And yes, of course, we also screw up sometimes, that's a thing. But you can also see when it actually starts, when it gets to a certain point, you can start doing all these fleet-wide optimizations. Oh, you need to do a kernel upgrade. Oh, you just click a button and it just happens. It doesn't happen like just immediately, but it happens automatically. And that was always the important part. And all those people who are left with their own systems, they're like, oh, fuck, now we have to, like, let's boot up a spreadsheet or whatever, and then we start tracking, okay, how many servers did we do, and, like, whatever. And so people can also see, both the teams themselves, but more importantly for something like this, managers and directors, they can see, okay, so we have this thing over here where stuff just happens. And then we have this other thing over here where there's a lot of, like, weird stuff happening. We can't really explain, and, like, we get new people in. They have to, like, learn complete proprietary things. So I think there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. And I also, like, I don't want to, like, say it's just because of resistance to change. Like, from people, there's also technology that is really hard. And, like, stuff like if you're running Kafka, if you're running HDFS, there's a lot of systems out there that we run at scale that are really not built for, like, a cloud-like environment.
Oh, yeah, where, absolutely, like, not.
You're not really supposed to change IP addresses, or you're not really supposed to do anything, yeah, except keep it running as it was when you installed it in the first place. And so there's a lot of work that goes into, like, okay, figure out how do we take something that was built for, like, a static, like, completely static setup, how do we move that into somewhere, like, this dynamic environment where we, like, we had a goal of every server needs to be reprovisioned every 30 days. So that means no container can run for more than 30 days. Yeah. And, like, for something like HDFS or Kafka, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Because
yeah, yeah,
they work best if they never shut down.
And there's a real cost to moving them around, like the replication.
And there's a real cost, yes. There is a real cost. And that's also why I think we spend a lot of time figuring out, okay, how can we compromise here? How can we say, oh, we want this perfect system, but we can also see that if we need to shuffle all data, like, let's say we have, like, maybe close to an exabyte of data, and we need to move that around every 30 days, that's a whole lot of data that needs to be moved around all the time. Yeah. So how do we, like, what do we do about that? So that we can realistically do this also. So it doesn't just become this idea that, oh, somebody just wants to do just because it sounds good on paper, but also, like, has to actually work.
Yeah, the reason I'm smiling so much is because I work on computer infrastructure, and over the last, about 4 years ago, I was working on OS upgrades, pretty much trying to automate this. And we were in a place where there was a spreadsheet, people were tracking stuff like that, and we are in the process of moving these systems onto, Kubernetes at this point. So I can very much relate to every single thing that you're talking about, although we're probably a little far behind in terms of the journey there, but I can relate to it very much.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think most people can.
So as a distinguished engineer, we wanted to kind of ask you, like, what does it mean to be a distinguished engineer? I mean, you see very few people with that title. And I think every role for every person at every company is different, and different companies see it differently too.
Yeah.
Curious how it was like in your experience.
Yeah. So you're completely right that, like, there's not, like, a distinguished engineer, especially not across companies, even hardly inside a company. But I think a distinguished engineer, as you said, it's just, like, the top of the rank, just because it's like there are no bit more people around, like, because. And it's really a matter of scope to me. Like, how broad is your scope? Like, how much do you think about when you build something or need to do something? Do you think about just your team, or do you think about, like, your group or your organization or some kind of super organization, whatever they're called, or is it, like, the entire company? And if you're thinking about the entire company, that's where it's, like, distinguished in your level to me. Once a company, and of course, there's always, like, what is a title? There's also, because there's, of course, if you are a 10 person startup, or even just a 10 person, like, whatever, mature company, well, are you then distinguished engineer? I don't know. Probably you don't have titles. But it's like when you have enough people around and the problem becomes become complicated enough, there's also a question of, okay, who takes the big picture into account? Who thinks about not just, like, your narrow little problem, but, like, okay, you have your problem, they have their problem, they all need to, like, fit together. Who thinks about that? And I think at Uber, at least, that's where the distinguished engineers comes in. They have a lot of experience. They have a lot of, they've tried a lot of stuff, you know, build a lot of things usually. And then you are in a better position to kind of think about, like, if we at a, like, a company level want to go in this direction, what does that mean? What does that require from a technical standpoint? So I think that's, and it's kind of hard to express. Also, there's not really a well-described, like, how to be a distinguished engineer kind of thing, because it also there's a comparatively few people who are at that level. I think at Uber we were, I guess when I was promoted, I was number six, something like that. Then we got two more and we were eight. And that, but that's all out of 4,000 or 4,500 people, engineers, right? Yeah. So there's quite few compared to the vast majority of engineers. But somebody has to like think about these things. And it's not that we all kind of think about, oh, well, the entire company all the time. Of course, we have like, I was like in platform engineering, so I had mainly focus on platform level stuff. But I think the big differentiator is really about scope and how you think about it. And to a very large degree, there's a lot of technical, to me, there's a lot of technical components to being no matter what level engineer you are. But the higher you go, there's more and more soft skills involved. So there's also just like, not only about how do we pick the right technical solution, but how do we pick a solution that is actually achievable? How do we do something that isn't just, again, like a whiteboarding exercise where we're like, oh yeah, this solution on paper looks pretty nice, but it will never get done just because of like politics or other projects need to get done or special interest, whatever it might be. There's so many reasons why, again, the optimal solution is unattainable, because usually it's only optimal from a very strict perspective. If we take another perspective in, it's suboptimal because somebody else wants to optimize for something else. Maybe you want to optimize for revenue. Somebody else wants to optimize for reliability. And now you're like, they would never really work out entirely. Yeah.
For the soft skills that you mentioned, was there any surprises in terms of, wow, like you know, when you were more junior, you're like, oh, that's not really, you know, that useful of a skill set to grow. But then once you did get to principal and distinguished, it's like, oh my gosh, I should have been like working on that a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, I don't think there's a point where soft skills are not good to have. You might, as a junior engineer, you might of course think, well, and I tend to still say this, it's all about just writing some code, then everything, like the world would be a better place. Get that done, you're pretty good. But of course, the ability to communicate with other people, I think that's important no matter what. Because if you're not able to explain what you've done, why you're doing things, it will lead to a lot of frustration. Because yes, ideally, you're judged on purely on technical merit. But that is just not how the world is. Because one thing is you have a good technical solution, but if you're not able to articulate how other people should use it, why they should use it, or why it's good or why it's bad, then you just won't get far. And that goes already from like a junior engineer. Like if you're at a very junior level, maybe you can just do the technical stuff. But as soon as you just go a little bit beyond super junior, you need to be able to like express this. So being able to communicate that without coming off as, I don't want to say it. And also be receptive to input. I say, oh, what you built wasn't right, quite what we needed. And they say, oh, maybe it isn't. And then go back and build some bit what we actually need. That is also to me a soft skill, being able to like both do the output of like explaining what you've done and take the input of, is what you're doing, is that actually appropriate for what you should be doing? Again, and this is again where the scope comes in. And usually you just think about your team and you think about your org and then you think about whatever, and the company, but all the time like growing that. So I think having those capabilities, I think that's important no matter what. Now, as I approached more distinguished, the higher levels, like I don't want to say I've always been conscious about my own faults, because I haven't, but I have at least tried to think about them. And I know things where I'm really bad at. Like, I'm really bad at anything that is repetitive. If I am to send a weekly status update, I'll do it twice, maybe three times, enough. Then I forgot about it once, and then it won't happen again.
I empathize.
Yeah, any of these things, but I'm like, also, why am I doing it? but that can also be a weakness. Like, and I'm not particularly good at like telling other people what I do. Like I can if I'm like conscious about it, but I kind of, it regresses fairly quickly where I'm just working on my own stuff and then I'm kind of done. Okay, now I can talk about it. Like, it's also nice to kind of keep people in the loop about what you're doing and what's going on and your ideas and whatever. And that requires like, for me, conscious like effort. And but that's also one of the things that become more and more important, because the more senior you get, the less kind of isolated you can afford to be. Like I'm pretty introvert. Like I'm I'm best with by just by myself. So having that whole thing about going out and whatever, that's an effort. And it's an effort. That's something that gets more and more important the more senior you get also.
And for communication, I assume you mean both verbal as well as written communication.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How did you get better? So that's actually how, you know, we first got into contact with you, is reading these like blog posts, which we'll link, are amazing. And yeah, like how did you like get better over time in terms of writing?
Yeah. It's one of those things that people ask me sometimes, where I'm like, I don't have a good answer. I don't know, like, because I didn't really, I don't know, it probably sounds like, I don't know, awful or whatever, but I didn't really sit down and think, oh, I need to get better at writing. I think much of it is probably just practice. You just get it done. Get it out with, don't think too much about it. Like, I have some techniques that I use when I write stuff, which is really about, again, really mimics how I do software engineering also, which is about getting something in, getting like the rough outline out there quickly. Not that, of course, you don't publish it. But like when I need to write something, for example, I take a new document, add bullets for what I need, I want the content, move it a bit around. So this kind of seems like a nice flow. Then I know that there has to be, well, this is something I learned, that there has to be a flow to what you write. There has to be a message. You have to like read it and then think, then you need to have found it interesting somehow. And you usually do that by you learn something or you read something that you didn't know or that was intriguing. And not too many things either. So like a single topic where there's a clear storyline of like, okay, there's some reason why you're doing this, and then it ends up somewhere. And so I try to kind of sketch that out. Once I have a sketch, I think, does this make sense? Then put it in more. And then I basically just rewrite each bullet as like as a section. And then that's it. And then onwards. I don't possess, for better or for worse, I don't possess the ability to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. I'm like, I write it and it's done. And this goes for like everything in my life, more or less. I enjoy baking and cooking food also, but I don't possess the ability to like really like do the same thing over and over again to perfect it. I'm like, okay, it's like 80, 90% good enough for me, onwards. Yeah.
That's how you get things done in a way, actually.
It is, exactly. It is kind of how you get things done also. But it does sometimes it's also, you can see you could get better if you just had the patience to like sit down and try it again and just to like do it five more times or whatever. But yeah, not happening. And yeah, I know that. I'm also realistic about it.
Yeah, I think it's like, let not be perfect be the enemy of good. And I think there are many few things that actually require that perfection, like in pretty much
exactly
software engineering and other aspects of life too. So you mentioned as a senior engineer spending time writing code or reviewing code almost on a daily basis. Now, as a distinguished engineer, or as someone keeps growing on the IC ladder at least, their scope keeps expanding, meaning they start maybe as a tech lead, then they become an Uber tech lead of sorts where they're delegating a bunch of...
I see what you did there with the Uber tech lead.
So as an Uber tech lead, you're kind of working with a bunch of other tech leads, delegating some of the parts of design. You're relying on them to fit in a lot of the details. But it also means that wherever there is a fire, you kind of have to jump in. Where one aspect of the design and there is not enough clarity on what we should do, you bring in that pragmatism or business perspective or the other context to say, hey, this is the right trade-off to make. And in those cases, it probably doesn't leave you enough time to, let's say, let me just spend an hour writing some code or reviewing some code.
Yeah.
So it has to be extremely intentional. I'm curious how you go about balancing this. I would put it as leadership versus execution in a way.
Mm. Yeah, you're completely right. It has to be super intentional, because as you grow, as you become more and more senior, people are just like, it's not as if like your manager or your director or VP or whatever will kind of say, oh, let me just leave him alone. They would just keep on shoveling on. Like, if you don't say stop, it would just keep on coming. So you just have to say stop sometimes. And when I say sometimes, it's a lot. where it's just about, because there's only so much you can do. It's not as if, oh, you're promoted to principal or you're promoted to distinguished senior. Now suddenly you have much more bandwidth. That's not the case, right? Like, you're still the same person. So you really have to like spend your time wisely. And I think different people have different opinions on what does wisely mean. And I have a very strong opinion that as an engineer, you need to build stuff. And that means writing code. It means reviewing code. It means being hands-on. Doesn't mean 100% of the time. But to me, if you stop doing that, it's like a time glass. As soon as you stop, it just starts going down. And you feel with what is going on. Also, your respect from your, not necessarily your peers, but like your all the teams who actually do need to execute and where you rely on their trust and goodwill to kind of get a lot of stuff done, they will kind of start perceiving you as more and more distant if you kind of stop being hands-on. So you can stop being hands-on for like a day, maybe two, and maybe you think, oh, it's working out pretty nicely. Maybe you do it a week, maybe you do a month, and it's kind of still working out. But then after a couple of months, you're like, fuck, sorry.
It's okay.
Or maybe you actually don't see that because it's not like a moment in time. It's just you're slowly drifting away from where the action is.
Yeah.
And all the people who are there will also see you drifting away to like, oh, you're only doing meetings, or you're only like, you show up when there's something important, or you show up when there's a presentation to be made or to a credit to be claimed, if people are really pessimistic about the whole thing. So to me, it's extremely important to kind of stay in touch and grounded, because it also keeps you away from these grand ideas we also talked about before that are like look good in a document on a whiteboard or whatever, but like when it really needs to happen, it's not, it doesn't really fit any longer. So to me, super important. Every single VP director type I have talked to agrees it's important. I would say probably close to, not a single one of them, maybe a couple, will actually do anything about it to preserve that. So it's really up to yourself. It's really up to yourself to kind of just stay in touch. And so that requires you to prioritize your time. And you can either do it very explicitly. Like I always just say, well, I kind of ran it more on a gut feel. Like, I have some stuff that I think is fun to do. And I have some stuff that I know I need to do. And then there's some stuff that I really don't want to do, but I just have to do. And I kind of try to like balance it somewhat equally. And then
I think
the whole thing about saying no. And again, you go up the ranks and you see more and more, like you're flying closer and closer to the sun, to some degree. The sausage factory is a big factory, right? There are many clean rooms until you reach the core of it, where the actual sausage is. But the closer you get, the more you're also like, okay, if I'm not doing this, then who is? So your consciousness will also start playing, at least for me, my consciousness will kind of start playing and like, This is stuff that if I'm not engaged in this, like, it might not end well. So maybe I should be engaged in this. But meanwhile, there might be other things where I'm like, yeah, I could be engaged in it. But why? Like, does it make any material difference if I am? And in many cases, no. It's just because there are already plenty of senior people. Maybe there's not a distinction anymore. But then there's a couple of principal engineers in there. They can do their thing. Maybe even not, but if there's something where somebody else can do it, then why should I do it? And that's how I think about saying no to things. It's like, okay, am I absolutely needed for this? If the answer is no, then I might do it if I find it interesting. But otherwise, I can just say, just leave me out of it. And maybe I just don't go, like, seek it out, because you should also be careful about what you seek out. if you're not part of something, just keep your mouth shut. Don't like spread your opinion about something where is that you're not part of it. But also if you kind of asked, oh, could you please join this? I'm like, I don't know. Seems as if you're doing pretty well already. We can, of course, just talk about it once and fine. But maybe I don't have to like be a part of it as such. If you just need a bit of advice, sure. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question as such.
No, it does. I think it makes sense. Like what you're describing makes sense, where you're being intentional about how you spend your time. That involves saying no to a lot of things, delegating effectively, where it's like if someone else taking care of some of the decision making where you don't need to be the one involved, then you kind of hand that off. I think contrary to that, let's say when it comes to writing code, because in a way, when your scope expands, you're accountable for something that's a larger deliverable. And there is more than one team working on pieces of it. And typically, when it comes to implementing aspects of those problems, teams are more or less self-sufficient, meaning like there are enough engineers on that team who would be able to get to a solution. May not be perfect and they're literate, but then when you want to spend that time on, let's say, writing or reviewing code, because there's so many of them, like in terms of repos that you could look at, code that you could review, potentially more than you have the time for. How do you pick what you actually contribute to, either via review or, let's say, actively writing code? And the reason I'm asking that is because it can also signal something different to the team if they don't know how you operate. Because if they see a PR from you once every week, they're like, what's really happening? Why is this person picking on my peers? Am I doing something wrong? As opposed to them knowing, like, no, this person's involved with this code base for a while. So I'm curious, how do you go about this?
Yeah. And I think that I'm not sure there's like a perfect way of doing it.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, you're completely right that less time you kind of get to spend on writing code, even though you kind of want to spend some amount, once you kind of reach a point where you're not coding like full time, or even like half time, or maybe quarter time, it gets really hard for you to be like in critical path of more or less anything. Like if there's features that need to be delivered, it's really hard for me to promise, oh, I can get it done by this time. By this date, I will be done with this thing, because you never know, like that time you're coding is like, it's all over the place. So I would usually try to not do too much of that, where I'm like, my output is strictly required. Might help for some small things, but owning like a big chunk, it doesn't really work, because there's no way you're going to get that done in a reasonable amount of time. Then you have to team up with somebody else to have the true ownership, then you can do some of it. And then I personally did a lot of like just like cleanups and bug fixes and refactoring and like Uber, we moved to a monorepo, and then that meant like, okay, so now we're in monorepo, and arguably if you monorepo, we should also look at like code reuse and like not having duplication all over the place. So I spent a fair amount of time like, okay, we're doing this over here, let's move that into library, reuse that, do this, library, reuse that instead. Okay. Stuff like maybe it doesn't change like the feature that you're implementing, but it just sets us up for success later on. So I spend a fair amount of time on that. I think one of the negative things about that is, of course, to other engineers, that might be, so you get to do all the fun stuff or whatever. You have no accountability because you're just like moving stuff around or whatever. And it's true to some degree that can be a perception, I think. But I think it's, again, about mixing it up a bit. So yes, much of that, but also just like if you're actually contributing to building features, just small things, I think that has a lot of value. And then I think one of the things that I also did as a senior engineer was there's a lot of tooling that is pretty shitty.
Yes.
But people just live with it. Yeah. And I have a very low tolerance for tooling that's shitty if there's an alternative. Sometimes it's like, okay, we're just living in a bad world and then whatever. But there's also just cases where it's just bad because nobody's looking, or bad because nobody's thinking. Mm-hmm. And then people just accept if you have like a team who's doing like developer experience and they're saying, oh, everything is fine, and like we are just on track and our roadmap is like awesome. But then on the other end, you have the engineers who are like, this doesn't make any sense, and like it's broken all the time or whatever. But they might not be comfortable kind of reaching out. Or even if they do reach out, they might actually just be like brushed off. But if you have a senior engineer who comes along and says, your shit sucks.
It gets fixed next day. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Suddenly, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be, and of course you have to use that kind of power with some responsibility. Like you can't just like do that all the time. But giving that voice to engineers who don't have the courage or the responsibility, like the whatever, to kind of reach out, I think that's also a big part of it. And again, you only know this because you're actually using it yourself.
Yeah.
And you're gonna get impacted yourself also. Yeah.
Oh, I think there's a key part to what you just mentioned there. I think to be able to recognize the parts that you could move around into a library, or to be able to recognize tooling that could be improved, there are a few practical things which I don't think are always true, but should be in this case. Like, make sure you have your dev environment always ready to go. Not that you haven't touched a terminal in a while. The other aspects are like, well, if you are in meetings where things show up with certain problems, just go look at the code and you'll identify maybe half the things that need to be changed. And those could be the things you could do in your spare time. Or when you carve out time for coding, you could pick those things up. I think looking at active code is part of recognizing the problems that you could actually work on. Which doesn't happen just
in meetings. I think another example is, so we had our fair amount of incidents. It's what it is. But the question is always, okay, so how do we then, what do we do about that? And how do we fix it? And there's always like the cheap answer is, you have an incident review and somebody did a bad change. Like in retrospect, a bad change. But of course, the change was made, somebody reviewed it, it was still bad. So now you can of course just blame whoever made it, and you can blame whoever reviewed it. usually that would be okay. How could we have prevented? Or we could have written better tests. And yes, had you known that this would fail, you could indeed have written a better test. But you didn't know that it was going to fail, so you didn't write a better test. So the cheapskate answer is like, you just say, oh, we're just going to write more tests. And then everybody, oh yeah, we're going to write more tests. But you don't, because you don't know all these things. So I think that's also a case where somebody needs to take a step back and say, there's something else wrong. We can't just say, oh, we just need to write more tests, or we need to increase our coverage, because it's not really an answer to the actual problem. Because the actual problem might be that our systems are too complicated, or we don't understand the interactions, or it's too loosely typed, or whatever it is. There might be many different answers as to like, how do we actually prevent it on a systemic level instead of just doing like the knee-jerk reaction of more tests, or maybe more alerts as another variant of that.
Oh, yes.
And that also requires somebody who, and I'm not saying, oh, it's always me, just like in the general software engineering sense, it requires somebody who has like a broader picture and both understands how does the code work? How does our processes work? What is the overall system architecture that kind of got us here? And how do we then kind of, what do we do about it?
The going back a little bit, so one thing that you said that was really resonating was like the sort of the respect aspect that you get from just right like staying in touch with the code. I wanted to see like your take on if, because for me, I thought that was super real. I wonder how much of it is actually being able to understand what's going on versus some part is just like emotional, sort of like having the sense of camaraderie of like, oh yeah, this person knows the exact shit that I have to deal with. And do you think that's like, I guess, can it be overstated that's like a huge part of why like someone even in management should like spend time doing
that? Yeah, I have had the same kind of thoughts. Like, is that an objective reason or is it all emotional? It's probably a mix. So we got a new VP of infrastructure at some point, or platform engineering at some point. And I felt he was struggling a bit getting his message out there, like what he wanted to do, the things that he wanted to do, kind of getting people to actually understand that and to kind of back it up. I told him at some point, like, in my view, and I might have expressed it in a different way back then, who knows, but in my view, there's a significant and material difference between a senior software engineer saying something and a senior VP saying something. If you read it up from a script, the same words coming out of two different mouths, that will, to me, make a difference. And it might just be me projecting myself, but I know if I'm in front of a senior engineer who I trust and look up to some degree, and there's a VP who, the unfortunate thing is you don't quite trust because they don't have this building thing going on. Like, if they say the same, there's a difference. And when I said this to him, he was like, no, but that doesn't make any sense. I don't know. Let's just say it doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't change the fact. That's how it is. Maybe it shouldn't make any sense. Who knows? Because you're saying the same thing. So it really shouldn't make any sense objectively, but it does. So, and is that fair or unfair? I don't really know. But I do think it is based on the fact that the people you trust, and unfortunately, you tend to trust people who are, I guess, more like you. And I'm not kind of advocating for like a completely uniform culture or whatever, but people who have gone through the same things that you have, that can kind of relate to the challenges that you have, or that you have had, I think it's much easier for you to like understand why are they saying something. So to me, if you want to kind of have a, like, let's say you want to do a top-down push for whatever, and that's going to create a whole lot of, you just know it's going to create a lot of trouble because realistically, also, most engineers are a bit picky anyway, so like they won't just, you can't just tell engineers, oh, now we're doing this, because everybody will ask why. Like, why are we doing it? But if you have an engineer next to you who is kind of bought in on the plan, I think the chance of success goes up significantly, because you'll be able to get this buy-in. And when I say engineer, I of course mean somebody who has the trust of the rest of the organization. It doesn't really help if you hire a new one, day one comes in and say, oh, we're going to like whatever, change from, I don't know, Go to Rust. Maybe it's a good idea, who knows, but they will probably meet a whole lot of resistance just like that. But if you have somebody who can kind of come up with can present a viable technical argument as to why does this make sense? It doesn't have to make fully sense. There are all times where stuff just doesn't have to make sense. But you're like, okay, it just becomes just because it doesn't make sense, we can still make it an engineering challenge. I think that's just much easier to get support for something like that from engineers if it comes from an engineer. And again, I do think most of it is emotional. The truth doesn't really change, right? Like, if something is a good idea, it doesn't really matter who it comes from. Like, that's true, whatever meritocracy is. Like, whoever has the best solution wins. But it's unfortunately not how the world is. So I do think there's a difference. But I do also, I think a lot of it is just emotional. But I think people are just emotional and we have to deal with it.
If you
try to ignore it, that's basically also back to the whole thing about junior engineers have to be good at communicating both inputs and outputs. It's the exact same thing. If you're not able to do that, if you just look at it from a purely technical perspective, then you might get a bit out of the way, but you will never get far.
Yeah, I think there's another aspect of this, which where you have the senior engineer who is trying to, or who is laying out this viable plan of a project which seems very ambitious and challenging. I think having an engineer kind of describe that, at least in my experience, puts the team at a little bit of an ease knowing that they'll have some guidance and direction on an ongoing basis from an engineer, not just management is telling them to go from, let's say, go to Rust or whichever language to this other language or whatever migration they have to do. It's like, no, we'll have this constant guidance. There is someone who is accountable along with us and they are bought into the plan itself.
I do want to say that, again, it's kind of back to that whole time glass thing about if your time glass is almost empty, it's not going to help. But if it's almost full, it's going to have a lot. So that's where, again, if you're kind of constantly in touch with engineers and building stuff and reviewing all that stuff, your chance of success for doing these big changes will be much higher than if you're out of touch. Because if you're out of touch, you might as well be a manager or a VP or whatever at that point, from this point of view.
Totally agreed. So a couple points. Guang just mentioned mentoring, and you have a really nice post on LinkedIn about mentorship. By the way, you have a lot of good posts, and we'll link to all of them in our show notes, and we highly encourage people to go read them because your writing is really good. In terms of mentoring, there is one thing which you mentioned, which at least I haven't seen very commonly mentioned elsewhere, which is being very intentional about who you mentor. And can you talk more about that? Like, what does that really mean?
I think it's kind of part of the other discussion, right? About you only have a limited amount of time. And you don't have to be like, oh, yeah, I need to like spend 20% of my time on this, 20% of my time on this. It doesn't have to be like that intentional. But you do have limited time. So you should use it wisely. And how do you get the most of it from a mentoring perspective? Well, I think of it as like you're blasting, right? Like you're blasting out, and it's going to have a like chain reaction down the lines. So if you are mentoring, let's say you're mentoring 5 people inside the same team, well, the team might be 10 people. And then, okay, so the total impact of your mentoring will be 10 people. Okay, so of course, they're better than nothing. But if you're mentoring one in one team, one another team, one senior person, one whatever, there's much more scope for them to go out because it doesn't really stop with you mentoring one person. That person will take whatever you do, if you're successful at least, because they will change their behavior. And in a lot of cases, that change of behavior is actually a visible one. Like, that might not be that people are like, oh, it's a new person. But in a lot of the cases where I've seen, the mentoring will actually lead to change in behavior, or can lead to change in behavior, like, and a better focus. Of course, my mentoring is all about all the stuff that I've written about. Like, remember to write code, remember to be nice, remember to think about all sorts of stuff. And people go into their teams and do that in many cases, because they kind of, oh, maybe it's not too bad of an idea. And that has an impact on the rest of the teams and other people they work with, because they also see, oh, there's some new stuff that matters. It seems pretty nice, so let's do more of that. So that's why I might have written waste about mentoring too many people, whatever. And sometimes you pick words that are also to create a bit of a controversy. But from a impact perspective, it is kind of waste, because you could have maximized your impact by doing it in another way. And that's really, to me, what mentoring... Again, I'm like an introvert kind of type. Mentoring doesn't come easy to me as such. I like few close relationships rather than a lot of like more loose. But still, so you kind of need to like pick them carefully. I think it's really about thinking about why are you doing it. And if you're into that company, you're doing it to maximize the company's kind of output or whatever engineering effort.
How do you go about picking like who to like mentor or who to go reach out to, or do they is there a lot of inbounds?
Usually inbounds is quite enough. But there are cases where, and that's probably more on the senior levels. Maybe you have a staff engineer or a principal engineer who you can kind of see has a lot of potential, but maybe that person doesn't quite know how do we kind of keep moving forward, because the expectations change, the skill requirements change a bit. You can't just keep on doing what we were doing. But some people, you also just want to help them out, also because it will benefit everybody, of course. When I seek out people, it's more on the senior end, because that's also where the impact is really high. If you get that right, impact is super high.
How do you start that conversation? It's like, hey, buddy, see you're struggling over there. Why don't I?
No, so I've never really been a fan of like formal mentoring. Or like, we have a plan and we have a schedule, whatever. It's just about we talk about things. And it's usually also a two-way street. I learn something about whatever they're doing. I think most of the cases is a little bit asymmetrical. So I might learn something technical about what they're doing, and they get more of the soft skills. Because much of the senior mentoring is really about soft skills. There's very little technical. You can talk about technical stuff, but it's usually all about how do you think about stuff? How do you behave? How do you handle weird conflicts? How do you handle politics? Whatever it is. So I think it becomes a little bit asymmetrical in that sense, which is fine. I think that's perfectly fine. But it also kind of gives you a nice entry path into could you explain me how this system works or how you build this thing? And then you're already going and then you ask, how are things going?
Interesting. Yeah. When they're not looking for feedback, I guess intentionally, how do you, I guess, so the sort of the pretense would be let me learn from you about this.
Yeah, yeah. Usually, of course, you don't go up to someone and say, I think you suck at this, you should do this better. obviously, any variant of that. I think mentoring and in almost all other things, the best outcome is that if the other person thinks it was his or her idea. So if you can kind of talk to them and say, okay, could we maybe also talk about how does a promotion look for the next level? Oh, yeah, we can talk about that. And usually those questions kind of creep up when you just start talking about work life and technical stuff. And yeah. So I usually don't go into it with I saw this behavior you had or whatever. We need to fix that. It's more about actually learning about people and having them grow.
Hashtag inception. I like it.
Yeah.
makes sense.
In one of those blog posts, you mentioned that at Uber, you had this document called Being an Engineer with essays from different engineers across the company on different topics and practices. This sounds super cool. And I'm curious, how did this actually start?
Yeah, it's a good question. The exact inception of it, I don't quite remember, but so somebody might correct me later on if I take all the glory and fame. But Uber was, and I guess probably still is, a very a promotion-driven culture. You're hired, and then you get promoted, and you get promoted some more, and people are like, oh, I also want to get promoted, and people are like, oh, how do we get promoted? And then somebody doesn't get promoted, and the person's like, oh, I didn't get promoted.
It's like PDD.
yeah. And so my view on that whole thing is, if you do the things that I kind of usually advocate for, you're hands-on, you code, you execute, you deliver stuff. Promotion will be a side effect of that. It's not the primary goal, but it will happen. And I know people were like, it didn't happen to me. And yes, there are sad cases out there for sure. But there's also just a lot of cases where you just weren't ready or you were actually doing the wrong thing. So at some point we decided, so given that there's so many people who kind of are focused on this stuff and it really shouldn't be, people shouldn't be spending so much time on getting promoted. They should be spending time on building stuff. And by building stuff, you get promoted. Not the other way around. So we were and I forget if this, but I think I started a document that was called something how to beat the promo committee or something like that.
Very provocative. I like it.
I bet it was the most viewed document.
But which really was, and that basically became how to be an engineer. But that basically just describes how are you actually a good software engineer? How do you write code? How do you ship stuff? How do you make sure you do good reviews? All that stuff. Nothing magic about it. It's just the title was a bit provocative. But the reality was that, so I've been in a lot of promo committees at Uber. Back from, like, and Uber has been through a lot of different setups of how it works, from like super unstructured, like Wild West crazy, to like completely promo committee with like many, many documents that people have to write and like whatever. But I have always looked for people who kind of do this thing about, you write code, you have a good balance. It's not about only you write code, but you write code, you talk to people, you communicate your things. If you build something, you go out there and make sure it gets used. If it doesn't get used, it doesn't matter. All this stuff. But we've never really put it into a form where, to me, was like understandable by engineers. It was like always like HR, whatever, kind of made these rubrics of like, oh, you like expect to do this and this, but it was always like slightly like non-tangible.
Intangible,
somehow. Yeah. So I think that's, I think that's the way it started. We just wanted to like have a description of an informal engineering-driven perspective of like, what does it actually mean to work as a software engineer at Uber? Like, you could—it's not the one universal way of working as a software engineer ever, but these are the kind of the things that we believe that Uber values and also makes sense for what we're actually doing. Nonetheless, it also has to make sense for the company, right? It can't just be about you building awesomeness from like a whatever, oh, you 100% coverage and like whatever, but if it doesn't get out there, get used, then yeah. So I think that's kind of how it started. And then it kind of expanded from there to have like more and more people would just like submit stuff and like, yeah, just, oh, this is nice. And then people write about commit messages or how to do stack diffs or whatever it is. Like a lot of different topics kind of went in there over time.
Sounds like one of the goals that this would also achieve is not just giving people kind of a perspective beyond the HR guidelines on what a promo looks like, but also defining what the engineering culture should be to an extent, because it's coming from a lot of people who are senior at the company, who are defining how do you do engineering that results in building stuff, that results in a byproduct of things, that results into promotion. Are there other effective means of influencing the engineering culture that you've noticed as a distinguished engineer?
Effective, I think, is a I think that's what gets interesting.
Yes.
Because culture is something, it's really hard to like just, you can't just say, oh, now we have culture or whatever. Our culture sucks, let's get a better one. That's not how it works.
Not something you buy, yeah.
No, it's something that you kind of need to like, if you want to be conscious about culture, you have to like, it's a long play, right? You can't just, there's no changing in a day or a week or a month or even a year. It's a slow, slow, slow process. And it's one of the things that we think we tried to do as much as we could. Like Uber, many people have been through a lot of like rough stuff. By now, most people who went through those things are no longer at Uber, not on the management level and not on the engineering level. But then the other thing happens is you get a lot of new people in, and there's a lot of churn, and especially in COVID times where like people also don't really meet any longer. You kind of you just sit at home and you like don't really talk too much. And that creates different kind of culture. So whatever culture you want is like, I won't say it has to be super conscious, but you have to make an effort to keep what you want. So if you want to have a builder's kind of culture, you have to nurture that in just the right way. And it gets really hard. One example, back to the promo stuff again, like I've seen a fair amount of promotions to semi-senior, like senior kind of staff level engineers. When they come from promo, they haven't really built anything for a while. They kind of stop building, and now they're just talking and designing or whatever. And I'm like, okay, you should build more. The other stuff is also fine, but you should build something. And then come back when you just need to see more of that. So get back on that and then come back later. And everybody kind of agreed, well, everybody, I wouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people agreed on that, including management. And then one day, Dara gets up and all hands and says, okay, code is actually so important that we're going to start counting how many pull requests people are doing. Not on an individual level as such, but on an aggregate level, just to check, like are we moving, are we regressing, are we moving upwards? Because we had been regressing for quite a while. So it kind of makes sense. And it also, like the underlying idea is to say, like building is important. We want people to build. That's the underlying idea. But of course, when people hear, oh, you're going to count.
Oh, that can be perceived.
Too like,
People go completely berserk.
Number of peers doubled in a year, yeah.
to a degree where it doesn't make any sense either. Yeah. But that's why, again, so you want the culture, but you can't just say you want the culture. You have to, like, somehow...
Yeah.
You hint at it without saying it, and you hope for the best. And that's where it's really inefficient, right? There's no efficient way of, like, changing a culture. If you just want to maintain it, there are, of course, a lot of ways. Like, there's all this stuff about writing through promos, through meetups, through mentoring. There's a lot of stuff you can do to just keep it where, if you're at a good place, keep it there. Even that requires a lot of effort. But actually actively changing it is it's almost impossible. It's not completely impossible, but it's just very close to, because it requires so much, like, intentional but hidden effort.
Yeah.
Of like, yeah, and it's such a manual, it's just a manual thing.
That's like super interesting. We're chatting with Josh Wills, who like commented on this sort of the pros and cons between like the hard power of management versus the soft power of like a senior IC. And one of the things was like, how you can change the culture or influence it. But to your point, it's very much early on, right? Like you're like setting, you're putting in these sort of guardrails or like systems, right, to make people like better engineers. But then to your point, once that's already set in place and you're trying to change it, then I think it gets really tricky. But so you're a founding engineer at a new startup now. Like how are you thinking about it? Sort of kind of inceptioning the... Wow, so much inception going on today. like the engineering culture, like from day one, like how do you think about that?
So I think, first of all, our initial team is mainly senior engineers who've like tried different things. We're like two from Uber by now. And we've all seen a lot of things. We've tried small companies, we've tried big companies. We know exactly what we like and what we don't like. I don't think we have we're trying to stay naive to some degree and say, we'll just pick all the stuff that we want to have and then we'll not do all the stuff that we don't want to have. at some point, that's probably going to break down. But I think we try to be fairly intentional about, like, what do we value? Do we value building stuff? Do we value people like middle? I don't want to like be too off-putting on like middle management or whatever. Mm. But I don't know. To me, it's a fact of life. When you grow an organization, it becomes bigger and bigger. There are more people whose work is like slightly undefined or defined by themselves. And that means when they're hired, they invent work. And it's not always good work. It's like pseudo work or meta work. Just because you are paid, you feel obliged to like spend your time on something. So if you're in HR, well, maybe I'll come up with a promo process. Or if you are a project manager, like a middle manager, maybe I'll come up with some reporting tools or whatever so that I can create nice reports. Okay, so, but is this actually contributing anything in particular? In some cases, it actually might be negatively affecting the company. So we have this possibly very naive idea that we want to cap the number of employees at 150. 150 is all we're ever going to be, because that removes all that middle layer of meta work. Of course, arguably, you could say, well, 150, like, there's a reason why Uber had like 4,000 engineers. That's because it was not possible to build with like 100 engineers. So how can we possibly build something? Because we want to be the same scale as Uber, like business-wise. But how can you do that? Well, I think it's a good question. We don't have all the answers. But I think there are two parts to it. One thing is, if you go to Uber now and you ask anybody in software engineering, whether it's a manager or director, would you be able to work more efficiently with fewer people? The answer is, I think 99% of people we ask will say yes. Fewer people, better. Yeah. Okay, so why are we then that many people? Well, again, you're hiring somebody to hire people. What do you expect happens? What happens? Well, you hire more people. And they don't all have good charters. And there's a very big reluctance to like, so you have one group of people, they're doing whatever. They're doing one thing, they have another group of people doing another thing, they have each of their manager. Now, if you want to do either a third thing or make it more of one, are you actually going to move people from there to there? Very rarely does that actually happen. Almost never. Unless people actively say, I would like to try something new, could I maybe go over here? Then they go over there, they get a backfill, and then it's back to normal. So this whole rebalancing of of resources almost never happens. That just leads, again, to waste, because you're building things that might not be necessary. And to be honest, we have had discussions sometimes of like, are we keep on building on this deployment system just because we have the time? Or is it actually the thing that makes the most sense for the company? And it gets really hard to like, I don't know, it gets really hard to judge as like somebody who's building it, almost impossible. But I truly believe that if you are super tight on prioritizing what you put your effort into, and you don't start building everything yourself, you just use what is out there. And yes, maybe it will cost a bit more, like in dollars, but the gain in just like company efficiency, I think, will outweigh that. And then, of course, there's a whole, we're doing AI, right? So the promise of AI is, of course, that you can do more with less. So that's what we're building. We're building more with less. And that's also what we're selling. And if we cannot apply that to ourselves, well, we have kind of failed anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So anyway, so I think that, I don't know, it's fully answers your question, but at least we try to be quite intentional about what we put our time into, what kind of people we get on board. Also, I'm a lot about building and executing. I also fully realize that we need, it's not the only type of people we need. So being conscious about like who are the exact people we need, or the exact profiles we need for the things that we think we're going to build, and then be picky about what we're actually building ourselves, what are we buying, what are we just saying, this is going to be too hard or too wasteful or too expensive, let's not go there. So I think that's somewhat. And as I said, we have a lot of senior engineers, we have tried a lot, and we are fairly aligned with all this stuff that I've been writing about. Like, half of it is actually just also explaining how do we want to operate as a company.
I see. That makes sense.
A lot of it is actually just to explain to candidates. Yeah. So we don't have to talk about it. We just read it.
Pretty effective, I would say. How did you come up with the 150 number, Akil? Like that's very specific.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's one of those things, right? It could be having 200, it could be having 100, but like 150 seems like a good number.
I forget, I think I might be completely off base here, but I remember some study done where it said like beyond 150, the communication channels start kind of getting broken down.
There is something about how many people can you reasonably fit into like your mental model. And that is just around 150. So it's not like a completely
random
number.
There is some science around it.
that's like a pseudoscience, I would probably say. But yeah.
like deciding to go from Uber to a startup, I mean, a lot of engineers at big companies, especially in a position like yours, have a ton of opportunities. Like you could have decided to go almost at any place, any other startup or any other big company too. What made you decide a startup at this point?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say I was like completely like, I just need to get out, I need to do something else. But I had been considering like, maybe it's time to kind of do something else. The culture at Uber, I think, felt kind of was changing a bit, wasn't quite what I wanted to do any longer. So I was like, then what? Like, what are my realistic options? And yes, I could go to a big company. There aren't that many of them out there, right? And many of them have, I don't know, over the past year or two, the reputation has kind of gone down quite a bit. Like, Google is not, it doesn't seem like a place where people like want to go. They go there because of whatever the perks or whatever. But there's also, it seems that there's a company politics and whatever. And like your personal impact is like, almost something you cannot measure in any way. Facebook has also gotten a fair amount of heat. Netflix, I don't know. And also, like, if I were to go somewhere else, like, what would I actually be doing? Would I build more? I had offers to go to other big companies. Like, we're building a deployment platform. Like, you go build a deployment platform. Like, I kind of built a deployment platform. I didn't feel it was shit. So I'm not sure I want to do it again. Because, like, I don't know. It also took quite a while. And I'm sure you want me to come in and then just be done in like 6 months or whatever. And then we're done. And
that never happens.
No, exactly. It never happens. So how would it actually look if I were to go to another company? And I wouldn't say I was fearful about it. But I've seen senior engineers come and go, and usually they come with like high hopes and expectations, and they leave defeated, and a lot of unfulfilled promises. And I think a lot of it is because when you are like a senior engineer or a senior like manager for the VP kind of type, you come in and like you are kind of hailed as like the person who will fix a lot of problems. Where like, realistically, you're not going to fix them as such. You're going to work on them. Over time, you might be able to fix them, but you don't, it's not as if you coming in itself will fix it. Yeah. And then the thing is, you come in and you have no, maybe you know a couple of people. Worst case, you know nobody. And now all that trust that you had, all the reason why you were able to get stuff done, it's now gone. Yeah. And you have to start from scratch. And in a lot of cases, there's not a whole lot of time to start from scratch. You maybe have a month and then oh, 2 months or whatever. But that's not a lot of time to like build all this, the trust that you need to get stuff done. And of course, also just understand what is going on. And maybe if you're unlucky enough, the thing that needs to be fixed is like locked in some kind of weird thing where politics or whatever, some people did this, some people did that. They cannot, there's no way they can kind of agree with each other. So like, what are you supposed to be doing? You cannot fix that. Then there might be like a CEO level decision that needs to be done before you will be able to do what you should be doing. So the whole idea of kind of doing that transfer wasn't particularly attractive to me. especially because it wasn't as if Uber was like complete shit. If it was, then maybe it would have more been, to me at least it wasn't. But there was still something. And then I was like, okay, I could also go the other direction. Like a startup is always, it sounds appealing, right? From the, like, oh, you're like sitting there, they're just having fun, doing all the new fancy stuff. Like, who wouldn't want to do that? Of course, you're scratch, like,
yeah,
but of course, you're like 45, you have kids and you have a house and you kind of get used to the pay. There's something about reconciling those things. But then there's also like, I have, my personal opinion is, I like building technology. I like building infrastructure. I like it a lot. But I've been at Uber, and I know, like, we were like, oh, couldn't we, why don't we use this open source thing, you know, whatever, why don't we just buy this? I'm like, it's kind of expensive, and there's a lot of hassle. So there's also reasons why a large company doesn't just go out and buy something, especially if it's like infra-level stuff. Yeah. It's super hard to sell. So that's why I'm like, okay, so if going to startup, I cannot do a startup myself. I cannot be the primary founder of a startup because I have no ideas. I have no ideas where I could come up with something that I would buy myself, that I would actually pay for, or be able to convince people that we should pay for it. I know just about no infrastructure. Well, of course, there's AWS or whatever, but like, that's kind of taken. but there are very few infrastructure projects out there where you're just like, you can build a big ass business on it, and it's like, it's something that you can actually sell.
Yeah,
it exists. That's not to say it doesn't exist, but it's just like, I cannot do that. And I would also much rather have something that I can actually explain to non-technical people. I would much rather work on something where I can explain to my mom or somebody I meet on the street, oh, this is what we're doing. Like Uber, we could kind of explain it, even though we were like a deployment platform, could really have been built anywhere. It wasn't really Uber-like at all. Yeah. But it was still like a business story. And I would like to be in a place where I could just like, okay, there's like a real world problem that we're solving that affects real people in a relatable fashion. Now, it's not as if they're just floating around out there, startups waiting to be taken of that.
if only. But,
yeah, if only. But then I had the by chance I met up with a guy I worked with before, who also founded the company I worked at before, Uber. And he was like, he also wanted to do something new. And he was like, oh, we should do some AI stuff. Like, yeah, sure, AI. And I was like, crypto, AI, more or less the same. I don't know, a lot of hype, not a lot of value, but like unreasonable, like value that cannot
reasonable time. Yeah.
Yeah. But then we started talking about it, and we came up with something. Well, maybe there is actually something where we can actually build something that will actually make sense. And he's like more of a business person. He has like a vision and he has a huge network. He's raised like a lot of money, I guess close to $1 billion. So he has like network for, and we did enterprise, we did like an enterprise company before. So, and we're doing enterprise AI now, and it requires a nice big network, and it requires funding, and it requires a lot of stuff. And so he had all that business side of it, and I had the technical side of it. And I'm like, okay, maybe this is not too stupid. And then we kind of went from there. And then at some point we were kind of working on it in the weekends. And we're like, at some point we're like, okay, I can see where this is heading. I also know where my mind is at. So this is kind of, we just need to do this now. And then here we are.
The infrastructure space, I would say selling to engineers is probably the hardest, because every engineer will be like, we can build it in a month. Why would we buy this thing?
Exactly. And even if you manage to actually sell it to the engineers have to then sell it to their
the managers. Oh yeah, absolutely.
And that's even worse.
Absolutely. So we're coming to towards the end of our conversation. Mm-hmm. But before we let you go, we would love to know what you're building at BeyondWork. I mean, you've talked about AI, you've mentioned it, but can you tell us more about what you're building?
Yeah, I think we're on purpose trying to be a bit vague about it. And it's not because we don't have anything, but we're trying to paint this what's called event horizon almost, of like, we talk about how we work, where we work, things we're doing, but we don't actually talk about like
the what thing. Exactly it is.
Strategically,
you're teasing a little bit. Okay, that's fair.
But we're talking about that. It's not that it's like super secret as such. But basically, what we're building is using AI to solve what I call stupid work, which is all the work that when you have a company, is all the work that you're forced to do that is not related to the core of the company. Like, if you are a carpenter, and I'm not saying we're kind of building for carpenters, right? It's just an example. But if you're a carpenter, you go out, you use your hammer and chisel or whatever, you do carpentry stuff, woodworking, whatever it is. But then you also have to do invoicing, and you might have some employees. So you have to do HR, you have to go do contract management, you have to do payment management, you have to do invoices, create notes, you have to send out reminders, all this stuff. Reply to emails. I don't know how many emails there is in carpentry, but whatever. But there's all this process that just to have a company, you need to do. Mm. But you're not really good at it, and you probably don't want to do it. So what do you do? Well, you probably use different systems, but now you just have like, you have an invoicing system, and then you have the support system, and you have some time management, and you have expense management, whatever. You have all these weird systems out there. So now you're that far. But you're still, in many cases, like transferring from each system to one system to the other, getting an email, copying from there to there. There's a lot of things that even though there are computers involved, there's also just a whole lot of people involved. Yeah. And as you scale this up, like a carpenter, yeah, sure, he might spend an hour or two a week. Not a big deal. But as you scale it up, if not linear, it might actually become more, not exponential, but it's more than just linear. As you scale up the company, you get more and more of this weird process. And you end up with these very large enterprises that might have thousands and thousands of people sitting around, typically in like maybe Eastern Europe, India, whatever. And like what they're more or less doing is the work of a computer, but because the computer is kind of stupid, it cannot do it. Because they take data from one side, pass it up, and put it into somewhere else. And that's more or less always what's going on.
Whether the data is in sorts.
Maybe the data is an email, maybe the data is an XML file that you need to kind of copy something out from because it's in a XML, but there's a node field somewhere. You need to kind of take some stuff out of the node field and put into another field that you know. So why is this? And that's because computers are pretty stupid. Because you have unstructured data coming in on one end and you need structured data on the other end. And ironically, the irony is that it's not like unstructured because it's actually it's actually formatted. Like might be an XML file, JSON file, a YAML file, whatever it is, but it's not formatted as you want it. and usually it's also formatted in a way that there's like not a one-to-one mapping. Mm-hmm. So there's not like a one-to-one mapping, it kind of gets hard for computers, as it kind of was. Yeah. But with the rise of AI and LLMs, it's actually much easier to get a computer to do it, not again, not 100%, not perfect, but pretty good. So if you can build a system that does that, and you can also build a system in such a way that pretty good is good enough, then you're really onto something. At least that's at least how we see it. Then you're onto something because there's so much waste going on in a lot of large enterprises, and they all know it. They almost desperately want to get rid of it. They cannot get rid of it, but by using a system like ours, and again, I haven't really talked about what it is. Or how.
Hopefully soon.
Yeah, exactly. But using a system that can use AI to reduce the burden of this work, if we can manage that, I think there's a very large opportunity to be had there. So that's basically what we're working on.
For sure.
And we have something running, and we have a system, and we have customers, stuff like that. But we're trying to keep it like a,
No, that's pretty cool. Maybe when you're talking about it a little more openly, we would love to have you back on the show. And we can talk a little more about Beyond Work. And Joachim, this has been an awesome conversation. We have learned a lot, and I'm sure there's a lot for our listeners to learn as well. People can find you on LinkedIn. You have awesome posts. We'll link to all of them as well as your profile in our show notes. And we highly encourage people to check it out. And Joachim, again, thank you so much for taking the time. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It was a super pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and learn more about us at softwaremisadventures.com. You can also write to us at hello@softwaremisadventures.com. We would love to hear from you. Until next time, take care.